We've got a lot of work to do here today. There are 10 little diagrams that over the course of the last 30 years or so, I've kind of drawn pictures for everybody because it seems like that's something that we all can share. And the one that we're going to look at now is organization and planning. You know, most of us would say, you know, planning is really important, but most organizations don't do it. Interestingly enough, there's some statistics that I shared with you earlier this week. You know, 12% of all nonprofit organizations have a plan that basically serves as a map, a roadmap, that they go back periodically and they say, okay, here's where it is we are now, but we know this is where it is we're going. So they see themselves as a part of a more comprehensive plan that they've committed themselves to. And, we plan, and interestingly enough, there's a statistic out there that 90% of all plans fail. I think there's probably an attitude, why would we bother, you know. But the point is that it is important. And I suspect it's important for the people that you work with. It's important certainly for your organization. Think of going on a vacation and you have three toddlers, you know, or just young children in the back seat of the car, and you say, well, we're going to go on a vacation together. So the kids get real excited about it. And so they hop in the back seat and they have all the things that they have for the long trip for this vacation that you're going on. You get to the end of the driveway, you look at your wife and said, well, should we go right or left? And she says, well, why don't we go left? And so you go left and you go a little bit further and you get to a fork in the road. Well, should we go to the right or should we go to the left? Well, let's go to the right this time because we went to the left the last time. And you continue to do that for 2 weeks, all the time in the back seat. And you go past some beautiful places and you see some pretty extraordinary things. But all the time in the back seat, the kids are saying, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? And then, you know, 2 weeks later, you pull into the driveway and they realize that they're home and they wonder where they've gone. I mean, they never really enjoyed the ride because they never really knew where it is we were going. And so all the places that they were seeing were only things that were just places along the way, but they weren't a destination. We never really appreciated them because we didn't know where we were going. And a lot of organizations are like that. It's kind of like we're on our way. And yet, things happen along the way that we don't celebrate, that we don't enjoy, that we don't appreciate, that we don't, relish in because, well, this is just something, but we're just kind of keep moving, hoping that we continue to, and we don't really know what it is we're continuing to do. So a plan is just so vitally important. And there are all kinds of models for planning, and we could get into some detail with this, but in the interest of time, we're not going to go too deeply into it. But, you know, some people have philosophies of planning that you really shouldn't do that. And I think I told you about my friend who one time was doing a video seminar that I was listening to, and he's a very prominent pastor, someone that if I mentioned his name, you'd probably recognize it. And he said, I just don't believe in planning. And I'm kind of listening to this video, and I'm kind of, I wasn't paying really close attention up to that moment, but all of a sudden he said that, and I'm thinking, what did he say? And then he went on to quote that passage in Matthew chapter 6, don't take any thought for tomorrow, because tomorrow's got enough concerns of its own. Seek ye first today the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. And he says, I just don't want to miss anything that God's doing, and so I don't believe in planning. Well, you know, I kind of registered that away. I was reminded of the fact that Jesus had a lot to say about planning, including, you know, don't go out and build a tower without first of all counting the cost, and don't go to battle without first of all counting the strength of the opponent that you're going to face, and so forth and so on. But as circumstance would have it, as providence would have it, about 3 years later, I get this phone call from this same pastor. And I'm thinking, well, this is really an interesting phone call. And so I answered the phone, and he said, well, you know, we're getting ready to launch some major initiative, and we're wondering if you might be willing to, you know, come down and kind of advise us as to how we might go about doing that. And I said, well, I'd love to do that. So I flew down to the city where he lived, and he met me at the airport, and we went to a restaurant. And when we walked into the restaurant, he had his Bible with him, and underneath his Bible there was a day timer, you know, a planner. And I'm thinking, well, why would anybody that doesn't believe in planning have a day timer? Why would they have a planner with them? And I'm just kind of amused by this whole thing. And so as we're sitting down, we're talking, and I said, would you mind if I looked at your planner? He says, oh, no, you could look at my planner. And so I opened up his planner, and I opened it up for 3 months ahead of time. And he was going to be in Toronto, Canada on a certain date, 3 months from the time that we were meeting. I said, well, you're going to be in Toronto, I see, on this particular date. He says, yeah, I'm going to be in Toronto. And by the way, every other block was filled, too. I said, well, could you have been anywhere else? And he says, oh, yes, I could. You know, at any given day, he's very, very popular and really well known. He says, at any given day, I could probably be in three different places. So I said, you have to choose between the opportunities. He says, yes, I have to choose between the opportunities. And you chose Toronto. Yes, I chose Toronto. Why did you choose Toronto? Because he says, I think God's working there. And I really want to be a part of what it is that God's doing there. And he says, why are you asking all these questions? And I brought back to his attention the fact that he did this video. And in this video, there was a statement. He kind of smiled and he says, well, the point that I was trying to make, and I says, no, I understand the point that you were trying to make. But the realities are, you know, people still plan. And sometimes our plans are adapted. You know, the church at Antioch said, you know, to Paul and Silas, you know, head out to Bithynia. You know, that's where God's at work. And or whatever they said, and they prayed and they fasted, and they really felt that that was the leading of the Lord. And so Paul and Silas take off. And all of a sudden they get to Bithynia, and all of this big roadblock. And the Spirit of God comes and says, I want you to go to Macedonia. And so they just turn left and they head over to Macedonia, and you know what happened there. And God really poured out his Spirit in some very, very meaningful ways and grew a church that really became the basis of so much of what it is that happened in that first century. But we have to be adaptable. But that doesn't mean we have to plan, because if we don't have a plan, we probably won't go anywhere. And it's easier to move, I've discovered, it's easier to move a moving object than one that's stationary. And as we move forward, you know, God leads, and we understand that, we can sense that, and we're obedient to that. But I think planning is important, and I think you would agree with that. Now, there's another perspective or a philosophy of planning that's kind of like consensual. It's called consensual planning, or what I call consensual planning. And consensual planning is, let's get to what we all can agree on. And a lot of boards have this position, which I think is very, very intriguing. You know, we're not going to do anything at all, ever, unless, you know, there is a unanimous vote. In other words, if there's not a unanimous vote, we're not going to do it. Well, what that results in is kind of like watering down something to the point where we all can agree on it. Well, could we agree on this? No, I can't agree on that. Okay, let's take it down another level. Could we agree on this? Well, I don't think I can agree on that. Okay, let's take it down to another level. Until finally you get to the lowest common denominator, and literally so little happens within that organization. You know, it sounds really, really good. There's a model for planning that basically incorporates that philosophy, and it's called SWOT. And all of you have heard of it. SWOT. And if we were doing a planning session and that was the model that we were using, here's what we'd do. We'd talk about the strengths of our organization. And we'd write them on a sheet of paper just like that. In fact, we couldn't even put all the strengths on one sheet of paper, so we have three sheets of paper, all talking about our strengths, and we kind of paste them up here on the wall, and then we talk about our weaknesses, and we talk about the opportunities that are before us, and then we talk about the threats that could prevent us from achieving our goal. So we have 12 pieces of paper around the wall, and I hand you a highlight pen, and I say, okay, we're going to spend some money. I'm going to give you $10,000 of Monopoly money, okay? And you have to spend all $10,000 on things that you see in these sheets of paper around the room. You can't spend more than $1,000 on any item, and you can't spend less than $250, but you got to spend all of $10,000. So, okay, well, that makes sense. And so you get out there, and you're marking this, and you're marking this. I'm going to spend $1,000 here, and I'm going to spend $500 here, and $250 and $750 and another $1,000. And so you spend all your $10,000, and everybody else in the room does the same thing. And I'm walking around the room with my calculator, and I'm punching in all these numbers, and the items that get the highest amount of money spent on them, then they come to the top of the list, and that becomes our planning initiatives for that year. And you say, well, that's kind of cool, and I've done that. Many of you have participated in those kinds of programs, and they are kind of fun. But it's not a good strategic planning model for planning the future of your organization. And you know why? It's because it lacks a destination. You know, what you're doing is you're really planning what it is, you know, on improving what it is that you're doing now. But if what it is that you're doing now isn't taking you where you want to go, you're only improving mediocrity. You're just making mediocrity just a little bit better. Now, I think, in deference, that SWOT is a great little tool, actually. Because once you've made your plans, then I think let's talk about the strength of the plan, the weaknesses, the opportunities, and the threats, the things that could keep it from happening. But don't use it as a model to direct your future, because the realities are you could get 10 people in a room and they could come up with 10 initiatives, and you could get another 10 people from the same organization and you could come up with 10 more that would be totally different. It has to have focus if it's going to be effective. You know, there's an example of consensual planning in the scriptures. It's found in Numbers chapters 13 and 14. And you all know the story. You know, it's Moses sending out the 12 spies. They look up the land for 40 days. They come back, and they come back with, you know, a level of enthusiasm. They've got a bar between a couple of them, and down hanging from that bar is some of the fruit of the land. And, you know, people are looking at this group of 12 people coming on the horizon, and they're getting really excited because nobody's ever been in the land before. It's like one of the astronauts coming back from the moon, and, you know, you just want to see what these guys have to say. And then they say, well, you know, it's a great land. You know what? It's just exactly like God described it to our father Abraham. It's a land that just overflows with milk and honey. We even brought some of the fruit back. We just, you know, the moon rocks. We just brought something back that you can look at. And then, you know, the conversation changes a little bit. And they said, well, you know, the people that live there, did you know that? The people live in that land. I mean, and they live in cities, and these cities are perched on high hills, and they're surrounded by thick walls. And oh, by the way, these just like aren't normal people. You see Victor, he's big, but they're even bigger than Victor. They're tall, and we were kind of like just like grasshoppers. And so now the people are beginning to mumble and grumble. And then the next morning, the newspaper comes out, you know, the Daily News. And there in the front page of the Daily News, the Wilderness Gazette, there's this headline, 85% of the spies are opposed to land entrance. They take a survey, and who loses? God loses. God loses. It's kind of interesting. In the Numbers chapter 14, around verse 4, it says that their attitude was, let's find ourselves a captain. Let's find somebody and let's just kind of head back to Egypt. Because, you know, actually Egypt wasn't all that bad. I mean, we had leeks, onions, and garlics. We had a pretty good diet. And, you know, we worked hard. But nonetheless, it wasn't that bad compared to this. And actually, there's a little passage buried in around Nehemiah chapter 8 which says they actually did pick a captain. We picked somebody to lead us back. And here's Joshua and Caleb. They're saying, you know, we can do it, we can do it, we can do it, we can do it. And what's their attitude toward Joshua and Caleb? Let's stone these two guys because they're really getting annoying. I mean, the point is that, you know, that was the consensus of the group. But was it God's will? No, it wasn't God's will. But the consensus of the group was we should just all go back home. Let's just go all back where we came from. So I think the other alternative to planning is that, you know, leaders should lead. It's kind of a novel idea, isn't it? You know, leaders should lead.
May I say, sir, that there's a very good analogy for the Eastern European countries, that we very much understand this concept, because we have a lot of the communist nostalgics that are, you know, dreaming back, oh, back then I had a job. You know,
oh, yeah. Oh, it's so good.
Trying, and a lot of others, you know, that are trying, I mean, look at the vision that Ruslan has, you know, and this is, it takes faith and it takes being, you know, to have a Joshua and Caleb, Caleb attitude to...
So
we very much understand that.
That's really very, very interesting. You know, I was speaking at an event in the Czech Republic a number of years ago, and Dave Patty, I don't know if you know Dave, he's here, and he's a guy that you need to get to know. Dave Patty, from my perspective, is one of the world's best youth leaders in the world. I mean, I've seen a lot of things happen anywhere, and I'll... But I tell you, there's not many guys that compare to this guy, Dave Patty. He's just a great, great guy. And he lives in the Czech Republic, and he has an organization called Josiah Venture. And I don't get paid for them. I don't get for anything. But I tell you, I love this guy. I honestly do. I'm so impressed with him and what it is that God's enabled him to do. He's just an extraordinary person. You know, he's one of these guys that years from now people are going to be talking about. And you ought to be able to say, well, I knew Dave Patty. I knew him. But then anyway... I'm speaking at this event a number of years ago in Milanovica, which is in the southeast corner of Czech Republic. And it's a great time. About 300 people just like you. All of them just exactly like you. And Dave's taking me down to the airport. I'm getting ready to go back home. And Dave takes me down to the airport. And he says, you know what, Jerry? He says, you know, you saw the leaders. These are the people that are going to go take the land. They're you. You're the ones that are going to go in and occupy the land. He says, you know what we're waiting for? He says, we're waiting for the old generation to die. You know, what an analogy. You know, because the old generation says we can't do it, we can't do it. You know, it's really better back to go back to where we were. And these people say, no, we're going to go, we're going to go. And what you see at the forum is you see a lot of these people say, we're going to go, we're going to go, we're going to do this. And I think that's what makes it so exciting. But I think... you know, there is a lot, you know, that's withholding. You know, a lot of people just say, well, we can't do it because we've never been able to do things like that. But anyway, leadership, you know, the idea that leadership should lead is kind of a novel idea. And I realize that, you know, that's you know, say, well, you're a part of a leadership team, and I'm not suggesting, you know, I think the board, you know, is in charge or responsible for an organization and creating the direction that it moves in and so forth. But I think, you know, you need to be aggressive and you need to lead. I've had an interesting conversation over breakfast this morning on a program that's really not working all that well. I said, you know what I would do if I were you? And he says, I'd take a plain sheet of paper. Don't be constrained by what it is that you're working with now and dream big. You don't have a vision that's nearly big enough. And this poor guy sitting here with a piece of paper with an organizational chart on it, and I said, you know, just erase it all. I mean, I'm not suggesting, this is like a really, you know, Jerry's kind of weird ideas and so forth, but if what it is that you're doing is not taking where you want to go, then why in the world would you want to replicate it or try to improve it? You know, absurdity, the definition of it is doing the same thing in the same way and expecting the different results. And so often we just kind of do, we live in a tradition that basically says it has to be done this way, and this way has never worked, and it's never been effective, and all we're going to do is improve this way so that we make this way better when it's never been working in the first place. Why would we do that? You know, why don't we just start with a sheet of paper and say, we're going to just change, we're going to do something different. Yes?
So at the beginning when you start new things, it's logical, but they're not big from the first day. How many years do you think we should give time before saying we change something else? Because we need to try a number of years.
Well, kind of hold the thought, because I think that's a very, very valid question. And where I have taken most of you that I have mentored during this time, and I've had some of you that we've talked, and others of you have just kind of sit in on this conversation. But the one question that I've always try to present to people is the question, like, you know, let's play make-believe like we did, you know, when we first started on Sunday. You know, let's just make-believe that it's 2022 and everything that we've ever dreamt of has become reality. And so it forces us to dream of what is it that we're really wanting to do? Is it just have a men's ministry that's successful or have a men's ministry that's transformational? And there's a difference between transformation and success. Do we just want to do it? We just want to do it because, well, that's what we've been charged to do? Or we want to do it because we want to be a part in facilitating the transformation of the countries of which we're a part. And frankly, I want to be a part of that. And I know that you want to be a part of that in Norway. And I know that you want to be a part of it in Croatia. And we want to be a part of that in Romania and Ukraine and Bulgaria and all these wonderful places that God has given us to serve. Now, let's walk you through the model. We have this little model, and it's so simple. You know, it's like, you know, you're like everything that I'm saying. I keep, you know, telling people I'm going to tell you something really something, and you, after it's all done, people say, "Was that it? I mean, was that what you said was really going to be so cool? Because that's like so logical that why would you even say that that's really cool?" But basically, there are 8 steps in this little model that I've created, or I've been sharing for years, and these 8 steps are really pretty simple. But I use this. This is the one model that I use almost every day in one form or another. Now, I want to begin by saying that the defining characteristic of a strategic plan. So, you know, we're looking at strategic plan. We all know about strategic plans, and we know what it looks, or at least we have an idea of what we think that might look like. But the defining characteristic of a strategic plan is that it's quantifiable. And I said this early. In other words, if you can't quantify in terms of what it is that you're doing, and cross it off at the end of the year that we accomplished these 4 objectives or these 3 objectives or these 13 objectives in the years, you know, basically that are identified within the context of our plan. If you can't quantify it, then it's not a plan. What you have is a good idea. A lot of organizations have great ideas. We want to do this, we want to do this, we want to do this. And it's kind of like out there, but we don't have a plan to get it done, and so it never happens. That's why the 12% of all strategic plans fail, because they just never happen, because they never, you know, we call it a strategic plan, but the realities are we have no way of being able to measure success, so we never know if we get there. And so a lot of people in the organization, a lot of your donors are frustrated because they feel, when you can figure it out, then let us know, and then, you know, we might just get involved. But as long as you're trying to figure it out, then let us know, because we're not ready yet to invest in a significant way in supporting what it is you do. Okay, the first step. The first step in the process of any planning anything. So just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. Not just your organization, but anything. The first step in the process is creating a picture of the ideal.
And I try to take people there. I want you to live there. And I know we talked about that, and it's kind of silly at one level. And you're probably saying, well, you know, Jerry, I know that's your world, but that's not my world. But, you know, you need to go into my world periodically. This is really not a bad place. And just imagine a world that's been transformed. You know, imagine a world, you know, without orphans. That the body of Christ has done just exactly what Jesus did to us. They've embraced someone without hope and have given them a family. They've put them into a family where they can experience and fulfill all their potential before God. Imagine that. Just imagine families, you know, that look a whole lot different perhaps than, you know, the traditional family that are kind of like the red and yellow, black and white. We've got people that basically we've embraced and we've brought into our home, and we're sharing the love of God in the ways that God showed that love to us. I mean, imagine that. You know, functional families with fathers, you know, that basically are leading, and mothers that love, and a father that loves the mother and they love the children. Imagine that. That's what you guys are all about. You know, and just imagine that. What would it look like in kind of tangible terms, as tangible as we can create them, if that became reality? What's the profile? What's the ideal? You know, once you create an ideal, then you can go to the next step, and that's you can assess that. That's assessment. Basically, it's laying reality alongside our vision. Okay, well, you know, I mean, Dear Arnold is involved in a couple of really, really big initiatives that I'm really excited about. You know, some things with some incredible potential to really transform and to reach people with the message of Christ that basically have closed their eyes and closed their mind to anything having to do with God. He's got some really great things. You know, and a vision of what that would look like. And so he's got the vision really clear. Now, alongside reality, you know, if you're going to grade it, let's say with an A to D scale, and I say, okay, how does reality look now, Arnold, in relationship to your vision for what you could envision it looking if, in fact, we were to come together and make this happen? And he would say, undoubtedly, a D. We're just, like, not there. It doesn't resemble anything of what it is that we envision. Now, many of you are not at that extreme. You may say, well, we're kind of there. We're sort of there. We're getting there. And so we have different grades of accomplishment in relationship to the goal, but we need to do that. We need to assess, and there's something very, very important about knowing how sick you are. I mean, if I'm sick, I want to know that. I mean, don't tell me that, you know, I know you're not feeling good, but you really know that I'm dying and I'm probably going to be dead in 3 days or 3 weeks or whatever the case might be. I mean, I really would like to know that. That would really be nice to know, because there's a lot of things that I would do. And so also with you. But if your organization is not as well as you want it to be, then you need to know that. And you need to know why it is and what it is that you can do about it. And that brings us to the next point. Because once you assess, then you need to quantify. And quantify simply answers the question, why? In other words, you need to ask the question to yourself. Why are we a C and not a D? Why are we a B and not an A? Why are we a D and not an A? Or a C, or whatever the case might be. And you say, well, that's really easy. The reason that we're a C is because of these six reasons. And you know, and people around you will quickly know what those reasons are. These are the reasons why we're a C. Oh, okay, well, I get it. You know, there's things that if they were realized, then you would be closer to being what it is that you want to be. Yes, that's true. Well, the next step in the process is we need to prioritize. Which of these do we need to address? And in what order do we need to address them? Because there are some of the issues that are deficiencies that are more critical than others. So you say, well, yeah, this is like number one. I mean, this is obviously the thing that would need to be addressed first. This is probably number two. I think maybe this might be C, this would be number four, this would be number five, this would be number six, and that would be number seven. So now you have a prioritized list of the things that need to be addressed. Now, in planning, we're not just planning one thing. We can plan the big vision, but then every part of a big vision, you know, has components to it. In other words, you know, there's an educational component. There's all kinds of things that need to happen in order for the big vision to be realized. And so we understand that. So planning is kind of this layered thing. You start with the big vision, and then you take the components of it, and you plan the other components. And it really is kind of a fun exercise when you get people into it, because you want to get a lot of people engaged in this process. And I'll explain how that looks in just a few moments. But once you do that, and so all I'm saying is that if you're planning in a number of different areas, you're going to have a lot of these lists. You may have 20 lists, and then it becomes the responsibility of the planning organization, or the organization that basically, or the group that's basically coordinating the planning process, to blend these lists into something that basically is going to be manageable on a year-to-year basis. Okay, but then we plan, and we start, you know, blending all these things together, and we put together a plan, and then once we get the plan together, we organize, and then we eventually pull the trigger. We're going to implement the plan, and then on an annual basis, we're going to evaluate how we're doing in relationship to where it is that we're going. So these 8 steps are really pretty simple. And in our family, we use these all the time. If my wife and I are going to plan a vacation for the year, you know, we'll sit down at the table and say, honey, what's the perfect vacation for where we are right now? You know, there are a lot of factors, you know. I mean, it's been a tough year, let's say, financially, and so we're going to try to, you know, have a vacation, but we need, obviously, to consider costs. Unfortunately, I've got lots of free air miles, so that kind of helps things a little bit. So we're kind of looking at, well, where can we fly for nothing and then stay for nothing or whatever. But we're looking at a lot of options. So we're going to fly to, you know, Kiev and stay with Victor and Alla. You know, that seems like a big vacation. You know, that's a great, we can spend time with them, and but they don't have much room, so we're going to sleep in the living room or whatever. And, oh, we're going to go another. Well, this is looking better all the time. Kiev is getting closer to the top of the list. But basically, we're going to look at options, aren't we? We're going to say, well, you know, what is really important is these are the things that we really want to accomplish, not just getting away, but coming back refreshed and challenged and motivated and ready to take on the world again, you know, because we need that little break that makes that possible. So we kind of go through the process. Then we kind of assess the opportunities. Well, here are the 4 things that we could do. Well, we quantify them. This would be the most important. Then we begin to, you know, to plan. And so we use it all the time. You can use this if you're going to plan an event. You know, you're going to plan a banquet. You're going to have a reception. You're going to have a special event where people are going to come together. Well, if that were perfect, if it was just 100% successful and every dream that you ever had was being fulfilled and all the people were walking away, what would they walk away with? What would they know? How would they know how to act after that event? In other words, we're kind of thinking about, you know, not only the perfect event, but the perfect result from the perfect event in terms of what it is that happened. What would be the perfect result? Then we're going to assess last year's banquet. Well, how did we do last year? Well, last year was a total loser. And we got a lot of people together, but nothing ever happened. They never moved on beyond that point because we never planned for them to move on that to beyond that point. I was telling somebody not long ago. I was speaking about a topic that I feel quite passionate about. And to the point, you know, when I become so passionate, people that basically are as dispassionate about that point, you know, as they hear me talking about my passion for it, get angrier and angrier at me. And so finally, one lady stood up and she says, I disagree with everything you just said. And she was, you know, she was not a bad person by any stretch of the imagination. But I was talking about, you know, some trends in education. And one of the trends to education, which is more educational institutions are using contracted faculty members than hiring them on as full-time faculty members. And she had been a contracted faculty member, and it was really a bad experience for her. And so she was just railing on me. She says, you know, it was a bad experience. I wanted to be a part of a community. I wanted to work with students. I wanted to be a part of a, you know, a faculty where we were interacting and engaging with one another. And it never happened. It was the worst experience of my life. And you are just full of it, Jerry. This will never, ever, ever work. And she went on and on and on and on. And finally, after she was finished, I said, well, thank you for sharing that. I says, do you know why it didn't work? And she says, well, why didn't it work? I says, because nobody ever planned for it to be any different than what you experience. Now stop and think about that. Because isn't that the point? You know, why doesn't it work? Because you didn't plan for it to do anything else. If you don't plan for something to happen, then the realities are it probably is not going to happen. In my book, Transforming Culture, The Church at Work in the World, there's a 2 characters in the book, and one's the newspaper man who's basically analyzing this church that had been so unbelievably successful that it had literally changed the culture of the community of which it was a part. And the newspaper man goes to the pastor and he says, you're not surprised by success, are you? And he says, no, I'm not surprised by success. We expect success. And I think, you know, there's an interesting point there, and you may disagree with the point, but the realities are surprise catches... Or success catches many of us by surprise.
you know, something happens that, you know, kind of is consistent with our mission, and we're saying, whoa, I mean, like, look at that. It happened. And then we want to use the person that represents or personifies this change. We want to use them as a poster child, don't we? We kind of put them on posters, and we put them newsletter articles about them and anecdotal stories, you know, and we're walking around saying, this is the product of what it is that we do. But there may be 99 people that were in the same class that doesn't reflect that at all. And so they're not sharing those people with you. But is it possible that we could have success rates that go beyond, you know, 1 or 2 or 3%, but, you know, they really, you know, are incredible. I mean, just think about orphans. I mean, that's a really incredible thought, and we're not going to spend too much time because we don't have that much time. But stop and think about an orphanage, you know, an orphan's relationship with a new family. The goal of their ministry is not just to put them into families. I mean, you could do that, and you could just exacerbate the problem. Now you just got another problem because, you know, the goal was not just place them into families, but place them into families where we have a plan where they can really become, you know, something, you know, that they're not. And so it involves, you know, the work of these guys and a whole lot of other people coming together to make this ministry successful. So moving them from the streets or moving them from an orphanage or a place to a family, you know, could be wonderful. But it also has the opportunity of being, you know, a devastating experience as well, and even exacerbates the sense of loss and abandonment, you know, that a child feels that's been taken out of one environment where at least he felt reasonably comfortable to another one where he feels like he's an outcast.
And it will be without the one.
Right.
It will be a devastating experience.
Yes, indeed it will. So we need to plan. We need to plan everything. And then organize, implement, and evaluate. There's so many things that I could say about this that we don't have time to say. But basically, let me just kind of walk through at least one process on an organizational level. Who does what? In other words, of all the things that we're talking about, who does what? You know, typically in an organizational chart on planning, it might look something like this. And what we have here at the top of the chart is what I call the planning committee. You know, the team that basically is involved in the planning. And this is basically, you know, the leadership of the organization. It's the executive director. It's the board. It's the people who basically have been entrusted the responsibility of leadership for the organization. That they're the ones that, and so they're the ones that kind of create the profile or the profiles, because, and I'll talk about that in just a few seconds, because that's their responsibility. That's the fiduciary responsibility they have as an organization in terms of planning. Now, you know, the assessment process can be done by what I call task forces. You bring people outside, you share with them the profile, this is where it is that we're going, and you say, we would like you together, and we pick these people very selectively, and I wish I had more time to talk about this, but we pick them very, very selectively, and we engage them in helping us to assess. We want them to know, we need their involvement, but we're not asking them to shape the direction of the organization. That's not their responsibility. That's the responsibility of leadership. And the reason why so many plans fail is we have people that are basically given a platform. You know, the worst thing that sometimes you could do is ask for volunteers. That's kind of the worst thing that you could do. You know why? Because you sometimes get them. And then when you look at the list, you say, I don't want this person. I mean, this person would destroy everything. And you kind of know that from the beginning because they've been a part of committees that you've been a part of before. And so the first person to raise their hand when you ask for volunteers is probably the person you want the least in many respects. Because what you're doing is you're providing them a platform to pursue their agenda. And that agenda may not be consistent with yours. And so one of the reasons for having a profile is you're saying, you know, we've established the agenda. You just need to understand that. This is where we're going. This is a non-negotiable. What it is that we're saying here is what it is we're all about. We need your help. And now we're asking for their creativity. We're asking them to help us to understand how, you know, we could accomplish this. Let's assess where we are. Let's quantify. And let's kind of think together through the planning process how we can improve what it is that exists. Well, then it comes down to, you know, the prioritization becomes the role of the planning committee. And for reasons why, and that is that you will usually have several task forces working on several different projects. And so you're not going to be able to do everything at the same time. And so consequently, you're going to have to prioritize your list because we want this plan to be successful and not a failure. And I'll talk more about that in just a few seconds. Then we plan and
You know, that becomes the job of the planning committee, and then the planning committee and the task forces work together in putting together an organizational infrastructure. You know, we implement that, the planning committee implements it, and the planning committee and the task force is evaluated on a regular basis. So the chart that you see on your sheet is basically a circle, which basically goes around because this is an ongoing process. It just never really stops. Now, there is a book on my blog called The Organizational Planning Primer. It's free, okay? So go to my blog, jerrytwombly.com, kind of go to the left-hand side, and just kind of scroll down, and you'll see the Organizational Planning Primer, and you can click on it, and you can print it out. It's about a little 40-page book or whatever, and it kind of walks it through step by step. You can kind of do this step one, step two, step three, and it gives an explanation of what each step is all about. It's a book that I wrote probably, a little booklet that I wrote maybe 10 or 12 years ago, but it's still one of the most popular books that we make available to our clients and to anybody else that wants it. So please go to that and get that book. And if you have
the name of the book,
it's called The Organizational Planning Primer. So it's kind of I don't know if a primer is a word that really would resonate with most of you, but it's kind of a starting point. You know, this will give you some directions and structure and how to go about the planning process, who to engage, and so forth. So it's a nice little booklet. And by the way, this is Victor. I was putting all of these books in PDFs, and I was hosting them in the cloud with Mobile Me. And Mobile Me disappeared. You know, they're not using it anymore. So I'm switching them over to, if you have a better solution, I'm open to hear it. But I'm pushing them over to, iCloud doesn't take the PDFs yet.
Google Drive is probably, you have a Google.
I'm using
PDFs
right now.
What's
the box?
Dropbox.
I'm putting it in Dropbox now. And so I'm putting that and then putting the link into them. So if you have a link that doesn't work, I've been doing it slowly only because I have so much to do and I don't have help. I am my secretary. I am the secretary. My wife is the financial person. And this is kind of our little deal right now at this point in our lives. Okay, so that's what I'm doing. So if you have a link that doesn't work and it says, you know, I can't get it, then just remind me, but I'll go through those. And there's like 10, well, there's probably 5 or 6 books you can download that are all free. So just take them, use them, print them, translate them, distribute them, have people pay for them, take the money, use it, whatever you want to do. It's fine, okay? I don't want anything. I just want them out, okay? Because we just have got to provide what it is that we need in order to get this done. Now, that's really a rush job, okay? Let me just say, you know, here's the organizational chart, and I do want to say this because I think this is important. So here's the planning committee. Down here, you have areas that need to be planned. And so I want you to see this because this is the direction that planning goes. It goes counterclockwise. Now let me explain. One of the areas where you need to plan is mission. Your mission. Now, remember I talked about mission statements? It's a combination of clauses that are separated by commas. Did I say that? Okay, so an organization that I work with is Habitat for Humanity. We work in partnership with God and people everywhere from every walk of life, comma. That's one clause. To build and renovate homes, that's another clause, comma. That's another thing that they do. To create community, that's another thing that they do. They realize that if we're going to be successful, we need to bring people into community because that's where they thrive. And then number 4, so that people can become all that God created them to be, that they can fulfill the potential in Christ. So here's the 4 things that they do, and every one of those needs to be planned. In other words, you need to ask the question, the profile question: what would this look like if it was perfect? How well are we doing? We're going to assess it. You know, where are our deficiencies? We're going to quantify it. How do we prioritize these? We're going to prioritize it. And then we're going to plan and organize and so forth. And so we're going to plan here first. We have a tendency to want to go over here, which is what I call 5 critical areas that need to be included in the planning process. And we want to go over here because this is more exciting to us. But really where you need to go is here. And let me say something, and I want you to hear this. And I know I'm talking fast, and I know you're trying to catch all of this, but let me hear me say this. That the difference between mediocrity and greatness, okay? There is a difference, right? You know, the difference between mediocrity and greatness doesn't cost anything. It's free. And it's free because the difference between mediocrity and greatness is how well we fulfill this mission. And the reason why we oftentimes don't fulfill our mission adequately is we never plan to fill our mission. We want to do something, but we never stop long enough here to do the things that we need to do to create the excellence that basically will yield our success. The idea that we need a building, and if we have a building, we're going to be successful, is ludicrous. I mean, stop and think about it. I mean, granted, you need facilities in order to be able to facilitate the fulfillment of your mission. But just having a bigger one, or a prettier one, than we had before, the reality is that that's not going to improve anything in terms of your fulfillment of your mission. And I think that's just really important to understand. That the difference between greatness and mediocrity is really something that's pretty inexpensive. Organizations, I know some really great organizations that operate in just, you know, facilities that would appear, you know, to be inadequate and undoubtedly are inadequate in many respects. But they're still great organizations. They've got people knocking on their doors to get in because they know that what it is that happened here is really, you know, a fulfillment of the mission. And then God blesses them in other areas. But think of a person, a troubled marriage. They're coming into you as a marriage counselor and they're saying, oh, we've got troubles in our marriage. Everything's going wrong. And the counselor says, well, what do you think, you know, would help that? And they said, well, we just need a bigger house. And you're saying, hello? I mean, who's going to move into the new house? Well, my wife and I. Well, is that going to change the relationship that you have and the stress that has created the situation that you find yourself in? Well, we think so. Well, I'm telling you, it won't. So there are five areas where I think planning does need to occur, you know, when you get over here, five critical areas. And I'm just going to state them real quickly. They're in the book, so you can read them. One is has to do with facilities. Not necessarily in priority order, but, you know, obviously you need facilities. You need something, perhaps a vehicle that you can fulfill what it is. And maybe you don't need to, you know, like in your men's ministry, you have camping and so forth. You don't own the camps, but basically you can rent places and so forth. But you need facilities in order to be able to facilitate certain aspects of what it is you're committed to do over here. A curriculum. You know, pastors have curriculums, don't they? They preach on Sunday, and they preach on what it is that they feel is important to basically address the needs that congregants are basically experiencing. And then we have small groups, and they have curriculum, and you have a curriculum for men because you understand that if they do these things, then it's going to be they're going to be more successful and be able to lead as men. Then you have co-curricular things, which mean that these aren't required. So get away from the academic nomenclature. The realities are, you know, perhaps in your church, like in my church, there are opportunities where I can go to places, you know. We don't require everybody in our church to go on a missions trip, for example. But, you know, a lot of them do. And when they do, they come back and they have a more greater passion for what it is that God's doing around the world. And, you know, there are people from my church, you know, here, you know, today at the forum. I've met most of them here. And they're saying, this has just been like a transformational experience. We had no idea what it is that God was doing around the world. And they're going to come back to our church, and you know, that enthusiasm is going to kind of filter through the congregation, and people say, you're kidding, that's happening, and so forth. And so that's really good. So we need to plan co-curricular things that basically will supplement what it is we're doing in a more organized fashion. You know, we need to profile, and we need to plan, you know, personnel. You know, who's going to work in our organization? Because not everybody that necessarily may be qualified academically to work in our organization would be somebody that we'd want to work in our organization. So we need to kind of, you know, what is the perfect match for our ministry to accomplish what it is that we've been called of God to do? And then the other thing has to do with size. How big are we going to be? Well, you know, my conclusion is that we ought to be as big as we need to be in order to get done what it is that God's called us to do. To get done. How big is the orphanage crisis in the world? Well, it's a pretty big crisis. Well, we need to be as big as we need to be in order to get done what it is that needs to be done. And then how do we do that? Well, that's a whole other thing, which is where we're going to go next, is the organization.
You say 5 points, but right. I counted just 4. Facilities, personal size, curriculum.
Co-curricular is the other one.
Co-curricular.
Right. So that is the fifth one. Now, let's take a look at the organizational chart real quickly, because this is like, actually, this is can be almost transformational if you really understand it. So you say that's just the target, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's in your book, and it looks kind of like this. But if you really understand this organizational chart, it's going to free you, and you're going to feel for the first time like maybe I can really get all of this done. And, you know, basically this chart represents what I call an initiative. Now, what I mean by an initiative, this is something that we're going to do this year. It may be that we're going to find qualified families, you know, or people that basically have demonstrated an interest, you know, in, you know, considering adoption. And so Ursula has these names of people, and so there's a program that we're going to, you know, place them through, and so this is something that we're going to do. That's an initiative. But he's going to have several initiatives. He's going to have an initiative, you know, to work with Sasha and how, you know, we can coordinate what it is. You know, that's something. And then he's going to have an initiative to, you know, with business people, and maybe it's a fundraising initiative, and it's going to fall into different things. And so you can have a lot of these circles, is my point. You can, each one of them represents one thing that you've committed yourself to do. Okay, in this center circle, so kind of erase these lines here, in the center circle is a person that you know or you have a relationship with, or someone within your leadership team has a relationship with, that you have absolute confidence would have the ability to be able to coordinate this initiative. So let's say that it's Troy. We're going to pick Troy because we know that Troy has some unique abilities, and this would be a place where he could really thrive. And so you, the executive director, the leader of your organization, go to Troy and say, Troy, this is our family initiative. We know that this is something that you and your wife are really deeply committed to, and I'm wondering if you would help us to coordinate, you know, this particular effort for this year. In other words, would you do that for this year? Now, parenthetically, two reasons why you find it difficult to get volunteers. And I'll tell you what they are, and you already know. But I'm just going to tell you, which I've been doing all week long, all that you already know. But I'm just affirming that what it is that you know is right. The two reasons why we can't get volunteers is, number one, or we find it difficult to get volunteers, is number one, we don't tell them precisely what we want them to do. We're almost purposely ambiguous because we want them to say yes so bad, we're willing to water down anything just to hear yes. And so we're saying, you know, well, we just would like you to do this, and, well, I don't know what it is. Oh, you can do it. You're really, really good at it. Oh, well, yeah, well, I don't thank you very much. That's really nice. No. Well, will you do it? 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 Please, 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 please. And they say yes. So finally you feel success. Ah, yes, they're going to do it. And then as you're walking away, they're chasing after you saying, well, what is it that I do? And you say, you can do it. I mean, you do this all the time. You're really good at it. Figure it out, you know. And now they're really annoyed because you picked a perfectionist. Because usually that's the kind of person that we want, isn't it? Somebody that's going to really do it well. Well, you know what the problem with perfectionists is? The problem with perfectionists are that they're perfectionists. And they never achieve perfection. So they're constantly living in stress. Because they're never satisfied with anything. And so what you do to a perfectionist is you say, this is what you do. And that's all that you do. You don't have, and you know it's going to be done well. But you need to tell them precisely what you want them to do. Now, the other problem why we don't get perfectionists, the other problem why we don't get volunteers, is we don't put a time frame on their commitment. In other words, will you do this? And they say yes, and you say thank you, and now they're on doing something that they don't know how long it's going to last, if it is ever going to last. And if they're going to be stuck with you for an eternity. And the point is that, you know, you just need to tell them, you know, Troy, we'd like you to do this. We'd like you to do it this year. We know that you guys are really, really busy, but we'd like you to consider doing this year. And this is what it involves. You tell them precisely what it involves. And it's going to start in September. We're going to end in, you know, May, you know. And so, you know, after that, you're done. And so he's evaluating on the basis, and you might tell him, well, we think it's going to take this amount of time, and kind of explain everything to him. And he says yes, then that's really good. Now, there's one way to tell whether or not you've abused volunteers. It's a very, very clear way, very, very practical. If you're walking down the street and people are crossing the street once they see you, then you probably have abused them as a volunteer. Or if you're walking down a hallway and people are diving into closets, not a good sign. Okay, this is not really a good sign. We're diving into a closet. What's he doing in the closet? You know, he's trying to avoid you because he doesn't want to be approached about something again that you're going to trap him with or her with. So just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. Those are the two telltale signs that you've gone over the line. Okay, now let's just kind of go with this a little bit longer. You know, there are things that need to be done. In other words, if we're going to put him in charge of the family initiative, there are things that need to be done. Maybe there's, you know, a home inspection. You know, you're going to go in and you're going to kind of look at the home, talk to the people, get to know them. You know, there's going to be like a home inspection. And then there's going to be kind of a curriculum, you know, that we're going to ask them to kind of go through. So we're going to hold, I'm just making this up, so don't, it may be totally absurd, you know. And then there's going to be a meeting with other, because you're going to try to create, you know, kind of a mentoring relationships between families that are taking on this responsibility. So we want to, you know, get them together and not only have this, do this by themselves, but then, you know, get together with others and discuss it with you. And then there's going to be the, you know, the
food.
Actual, huh?
Food.
Food. All right, you need food. Okay. All right, whatever. Okay, now, so these are the four things. Let's say, and there may be more. You could kind of fill this out, you know. But what you're trying to do is you're trying to slice the pie, okay? I mean, we're going to eat this pie, but I can't eat all that pie. No, you can't eat all the pie. So we're going to slice it up. It's called slicing and dicing, and that's what the key to development is. Successful development is slicing the pie into components that are edible. All right. Now, what we're asking Troy to do is, well, Troy, you know, you need to find somebody that will coordinate this. And he says, well, I know somebody that will do that. You know, Jim would be really, Jim and his wife, Nancy, they'd be great at this. This is what they do. And then I know somebody over here, and this is going to be Pavel and his wife, and this is going to be, you know, Paul and his wife. Or, well, Paul and Pavel, the same person, but anyway. But you're getting the point. And then this is going to be James. This is going to be Jerry and Sue, okay? And so Troy, this is really important to hear, and then we're going to come back and talk. Troy is going to identify these people because he knows these people. And this is the important part. The problem with a lot of volunteer situations when you're getting volunteers is you get a lot of people volunteer, and you know, you ask them to volunteer and they volunteer, but they may not be equipped to do the job, and they may not be compatible with the other people that are part of the group. But Jim, or Troy, is always going to pick people that he can work with, that he knows, and he feels are qualified to do the job. Very, very important point. You're not asking for volunteers. We're picking the people that we want. Now, Jim knows that in order to do this, that has different components. You know, it may have inspection as somebody coming up with the documents, another one to evaluate the documents, somebody, whatever the case might be. And so Jim, down here, picks, you know, Joe and Victor and whatever. I mean, so now you have a group of people. You have five people here, but all that Troy does, and we're going to come back and talk about this after the break, okay? But all that Troy does is he manages these four people. That's all that he does. All that you do as the executive director is you pour your life, your inspiration, your vision. You pour it into Troy and say, Troy, this is what we could do. These are the things that we could do. Oh, yeah, I could get this, Jerry. And I'm going to meet with Troy on a regular basis, but I'm not going to get messed up. I'm not going to micromanage what it is that I have just given him. I have given him the responsibility, and I'm going to hold him accountable to get it done. But we know each other. I picked him personally. I know I can work with him. So Troy, my time is with Troy. Troy's time is with four people, and these people work with these five people, and we give them a task, and we tell them what it is to do, and they get it done, and everybody's happy. And what you're doing as the executive director of the organization is you're managing people. You're pouring yourself into people. As long as you start getting into all of this, you know what? You're not going to be back next year, the year thereafter, or whatever. You're going to crash and burn. You have got to learn to leverage yourself. You're one person with 168 hours a week, 24 hours a day. The minutes are still 60 minutes an hour, and you only have that amount of time, and you've got a life besides what it is that you're doing in terms of ministry. So you have got to figure out how you can get this done, and the only way you're going to get it done is in bite-sized portions with a few key people. Take just five initiatives this year. Five initiatives. Find five people that you can pour your life into. Work with them. And let that be a part. You know, our plan is to address this. Well, we're going to get these five initiatives done, and boom, 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 it's going to happen. Now, I know that's really quick, and we get a break, and he's got both feet on the ground, so let's go.